This is Eleanor Swent continuing an interview with Jack Havard on Saturday, October 26, 1991. We're in Piedmont, California. This is our fourth interview, and there are a couple of things that I thought we should, little gaps that we need to fill in from before. One was Sewell Avery. You mentioned him, and we didn't really identify him. He was the head of U.S. Gypsum.
Well, he was the chairman of the United States Gypsum Company when I joined it, and had been a major factor in the successful operation of that company, and established policies and so on. He was a man of very firm convictions, one being that people should stand on their own feet and the government should stay out of the way. He therefore felt that his employees should save their money and provide for their own old age. And
but at that time, he wasn't alone in that.
No, he was an exaggerated case, I would think.
Uh-huh.
And because of his success with U.S. Gypsum, he was asked to head the Montgomery Ward, which was in considerable trouble at that time. And he became noted in the news because he refused to follow some of the government wartime edicts, which I forget the details, but the amusing part was that Franklin Roosevelt sent troops in to his office, and they carried him out of his office. And this picture of Sewell Avery in the hands of two soldiers, sitting in the hands of two soldiers, and grinning from ear to ear, made the newspapers all over the country.
Did you ever meet him?
I met him a couple of times, and particularly in talking about future places to look for gypsum resources.
So he was pretty much involved then.
He still kept an interest. He was chairman of the board, and he was, of course, a very intelligent man with broad interests, but he certainly was an ultra-conservative. The problem was that he had these beliefs that his employees should be independent. He paid low wages and salaries, so this was inconsistent and resulted in high turnover of executives and engineers. In fact, when I left U.S. Gypsum, there was a story in the business pages of the Chicago Daily News about the turnover at U.S. Gypsum, and listed something on the order of 20 people, including me, that I left. The good side of this, in which I participated, was the fact that with that high turnover, there was a great opportunity for young men to rise up in the organization.
I don't recall whether we said, how much were you paid when you worked for U.S. Gypsum? Do you want to say, or do you remember?
Well, when I went into Chicago, I was paid $1,000 a month.
Yes, I guess you had said that.
And that rose a little bit over the years I was there. When I went to Potash County of America, I doubled my salary and acquired a group with the conventional benefits that were coming along at that point.
How is Sewell spelled?
S-E-W-E-L-L.
Okay.
A-V-E-R-Y.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's kind of, you weren't a vice president of U.S. Gypsum.
No.
And yet you had acquaintance with the chairman of the board. He was talking to you about what you were doing.
Oh, yes.
And, is that usual?
Well, I think so. They were, I had the job of ensuring their mineral resources, not only gypsum, but other minerals too. And I set myself the objective of trying to see that every facility had a 50-year supply of whatever it was, whatever rock, where that was possible.
Mm.
And of course, we were looking elsewhere. And when I made investigations of the deposits in Jamaica and in the Dominican Republic, I would come back and prepare a presentation, which would be made to the officers of the company.
I see. Yeah.
So I was well acquainted with the top brass.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to explain a little bit about faith not becoming a missionary?
Well, that's just me.
Oh, I see. I didn't know. You mentioned
she was a dance major at the University of Wisconsin for 2 years.
Uh-huh.
And lived in the president's house because the president of the university was her uncle.
Uh-huh.
And had some very interesting experiences there and the people she met and so on. But then as the war approached, she got the idea that she wanted to be a medical missionary, and I think this was probably resulted from her acquaintance with a Father Boynton, B-O-I-N-T-O-N, who was the priest in charge of St. Francis House, the University Episcopal Chapel. And he was a remarkable man, later became Bishop of Puerto Rico for the Anglican Church there. And she then left the dance majoring and went to St. Luke's Hospital in Chicago to become a registered nurse with the objective of being a nursing or medical missionary. And I'm the guy that interrupted that.
I see. Okay.
She became a medical missionary to Midland and other places along the way.
Did she ever work in any of the hospitals where you were?
No, there weren't any other, and by the time we got to Carlsbad, for instance, we had three children and a fourth one on the way, so.
She was doing her nursing at home.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, it seemed to me that we skipped over fiberboard a little quickly, that there might have been more things you would want to say after I looked at this report that you left me. You said that you built the new plant at Antioch, but I wondered if there was more you wanted to say about that machinery. Or
of course, when the merger took place with the fiber board, Babco and the Babco fiber board merger, we combined a lot of departments, and one of the ones we combined was the two engineering departments under Bob Hellinger at my insistence. And the chief engineer for Fireboard went on to manage the big operation at the San Joaquin pulp paper mill. For the combined companies, we built a lot of new facilities, and we improved a lot of the old facilities. I've mentioned the mill at the San Joaquin, where we installed a complete new unit, including the digester, and right on through the paper machine itself, paperboard machine itself. Along with that work, we did a lot of pioneering work in environmental controls at that plant, because the air and water quality control boards had just been formed. And I will say for the that the officers of Fireboard were very cooperative with me in working to really solve those problems, and we did cease discharge into the Delta, I guess the San Joaquin River, probably, and we did a tremendous amount of work in reducing the air pollution from the mm-hmm. which is just natural from the pulp mill, which is not particularly harmful but smells bad.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget that. The last thing we were trying to round up was a chemical called methyl mercaptan. Mm. And it is extremely odoriferous in parts per, a few parts per million or less. Mm. I remember that we would periodically get complaints from as far away as Stockton, people smelling this stuff. And we had a terrible time corralling it. And one of the amusing parts of the corralling process was that we sent out sniffing teams and automobiles and under different weather conditions, taking the roads around the plant and recording what they smelled. Eventually, we caught it by a incineration process. But that whole task of meeting the new air and water requirements was extremely interesting and challenging, and we were pretty successful in doing it. One other thing I might mention while we're on the subject of Fireboard is that we knew that Emeryville, that big, complicated facility, was doomed. It was generally obsolete, and we began replacing it with individual plants built elsewhere. For instance, the roofing plant at Emeryville was replaced by a new roofing plant at Martinez. And we were aware that in the end we were going to have to get out of there. So I initiated the first planning for the use of the land after it ceased to be a production facility. And while this work was very preliminary and done, hired by, or accomplished by some specialized consultants that we hired to help us, now of course the plant is gone, and when you drive by there you see lots of new buildings and mm-hmm. tall apartment houses. And across the way, where the dump that used to be, there are new buildings. And so that all came about in due course of time.
You owned the land.
Yes.
Didn't you?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Probably turned out to be as valuable as the production had been.
I was gone when they actually began the moves.
But that's very valuable real estate.
To sell that land must have been very valuable.
Mm-hmm. Now, there were gypsum mines.
Well, we... we really did so many things, it's hard to talk about them all without being much too lengthy, but Bill Keady was particularly interested in expanding the gypsum business of originally Pabco and then Fiberboard. So we went about it, and some interesting things happened. The company had held for many years I think several thousand acres of land near Las Vegas that was very isolated and consisted of a most unusual deposit of gypsum, which was entirely selenite, which is a platy form of gypsum. And we were running out of rock type gypsum near Las Vegas, and we had some problems of access to this land, but I sent our mining engineer out to look at it, and I think he had to get permission from the Army to cross some Army ground to get into this place. And he went out there and he was astounded by what he saw. It was a huge deposit. So he came back and reported to me, and we put drill crews out there and went to work on the deposit, and we found something on the order of 1 billion tons of this selenitic gypsum. Well, that solved our problem from the standpoint of resource, but we had to find out how to use this, how to clean this stuff in the first place, because there's a lot of clay in it, and how to use it, because that type of platy gypsum hadn't been used in the United States. And so we hired some metallurgical firm to help us with the testing and the development of a flow sheet. And the outcome of it all was that we built a road to the highway near Las Vegas, and we also were careful to make arrangements that a railroad could be built parallel to that road and connect with the main line of the Indian Pacific. And we built a recovery plant, which was unique, and started feeding the Southgate gypsum plant with this new gypsum, which brought in endless technological and problems and problems of what you might call the art of making Ford out of an entirely different type of material. But we succeeded, and today there is a very large Ford plant out on that deposit that was built. First, it was built by Johns Manville, which bought the property from Fireboard as Fireboard disintegrated, and is now owned by the California Gypsum Company. And the railroad was built, and the whole thing has been a success, so that was a very interesting story. We also located some deposits in Colorado on the east slope of the Rockies, and we built a new board plant at Florence, Colorado, which was really a very interesting design and was a very successful plant.
Did you do your own designing on the plant?
Yeah, and we built its twin at Newark, California, which was just as good mechanically, but didn't operate as well because the labor force wasn't as good. And we could get the
Newark bigger, that's yeah. right down here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You could get better laborers in Colorado.
Well, anymore we just simply had better crew in Colorado. They tuned up that machine and just ran it beautifully. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Newark we had more starter problems, and it just wasn't. And then the problem was people, as far as good.
Hmm.
That goes for the manager on down.
And what is the difference?
Well, I think it goes. I think we didn't choose as good a manager.
Mm.
That's the prime thing, you know.
But how does this show up in absenteeism?
Well, it showed up in a much slower startup, you know, getting the bugs out of a new plant and getting it running well. And then it just never was efficient as this twin in Colorado.
Production is accident?
It was an interesting comparison of identical plants in two completely different circumstances.
I was just wondering specifically where it shows up in more accidents?
Production efficiency, speed on the machine, and quality, and so on. Very interesting.
You said you hired a metallurgical consultant on this other gypsum in Nevada. Do you remember the name of the company?
Yeah, that was it was a successor to the Western Machinery Company.
Western
WEMCO, I think it was called at that time.
Mm-hmm.
It later was absorbed by other.
Now you designed your own machines for these plants, did you?
The gypsum machines were built by a specialized machine maker.
Who is that?
Coal manufacturing company. But that is the actual board machine and the dryer. Of course, we had to write the specifications for
mm-hmm.
And we also had to design our own front end of the plant, the calcining part.
So first you treat the gypsum, and then you put it between board.
Well, you as I explained, talking about in Midland, you take the gypsum rock, crush it,
uh-huh.
and grind it, and calcine it, which makes the gypsum active as a plaster. And you ship that over, carry that over to the board plant, and the board machine itself is a very long machine, depending upon the capacity of the plant, but several hundred feet long, usually. And there's a big roll of special wad paper over 4 feet wide that unrolls and moves through the bottom of a set of master rolls. Then the gypsum slurry, which consists of the stucco that we have sent over from the calcining plant, plus water, plus fibers, and plus some chemicals, especially foam-making chemicals, is fed onto this lower sheet of paper, and the manila outside paper of the gypsum board is fed in on top then, and this sandwich goes through the master rolls and is formed, and then travels down a long belt where it's, the gypsum sets up and you have the board formed. You arrive at a cutter at the far end of this conveyor, which cuts the gypsum board to the proper length. And then it's transferred into a multi-deck kiln where it's dried. And then when it emerges from the kiln, it goes into the automatic packaging equipment, handling equipment.
Now, where did the difference between the platy gypsum and the rock gypsum, where did that make the difference?
Well,
the beginning? Or the
it was physically different. And when it was going into the calciner, it went into these little plates instead of little particles.
Mm-hmm.
And it made some subtle differences in handling, which I don't recall. As in many processes, there's some art involved.
Mm-hmm.
And the art of redeveloping the right gypsum crystals that will interweave with the paper and behave properly is a little tricky.
Mm-hmm.
And dealing with a new material, we had to solve a lot of problems, and I guess you would say are in the form of the art rather than chemistry or anything like that.
So you had to do some trial and error
things.
Uh-huh. And the new machine that you put in at Antioch, did you do the research on this, or did you go out and buy a new machine?
We did the our engineering department did the layout of the new plant and the flow sheet and specified all the equipment that was to be used. And of course, we bought the equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And the paper machine itself was bought from a specialized machine maker named Black Clawson. And the other, you know, they're just big pieces of machinery that we bought and installed. The actual detailed design and construction was done by Bechtel. On a competitive basis, not on a bid basis, but competitive basis with a couple other contractors that were invited to make proposals. Mm-hmm. And it was a successful job.
You had some very high powered people on the fiber board of directors, big local
names.
Yes,
they did. Yes, they were a high powered group.
Did you have close contact with them?
Well, I had to go to every board meeting and present what we were doing, which depended upon what my duties were, and my duties varied quite a bit over the 9 years I was with Fire Board until finally I was in charge of the engineering and resources. But I did have to make a presentation every month at the board meeting.
Do you want to mention any of the people? I don't know any of them personally, but there's some prominent names, Herman Flieger and Porter Sesnon. Those are both old
San Francisco
families.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I think I've mentioned Emmett Solomon.
Uh-huh, you did mention.
Who was of particular help to me when I was working to get something going at Kaiser Engineers. They were they're all very friendly to me.
Did they know anything about the business, or were they just friends of other people on the board?
You mean the directors?
Uh-huh. How did they get to be directors?
I think the entire crew was there when I went with Pepco, and I think Bill Keating had picked these people. Some of them, I think, were all the directors of the old Pepco, but I'm sure that some of the ones he picked, and the board didn't change when Fiberboard was acquired, because Fiberboard had been half owned by the two companies.
That was a pretty tight little club, was it?
Well, I think you might call it that. They were very decent people. They weren't the old classical capitalists that didn't think of anything but money. They were, as a group, I would say they were very decent people and interested in what was going on.
Just a second.
Well, I'm sort of wondering what makes a company just go away?
Well,
disintegrate, I think is the word you use.
Yes, and
must come from something the board does or doesn't do.
Well, I think it can also result from exterior problems. Most of Fiberboard's business was regional, whether it was in building materials or whether it was in packaging. The company was a regional company, and the big national competitors really made it tough on a regional outfit. And then I think they made some mistakes and the top personnel. Of course, I would think that.
Did the change from railroads to trucking have a big effect on their business?
Not on fiberboard, but it did on the big producers like U.S. Gypsum, which tried hard to force all shipments to be made by rail. And that was a very good arrangement for them. And when the trucking came, it brought with it also some small new competitors, which USG knew that it would. So, but of course, over the years, they had to accommodate and accept that trucking as a major part of their transportation of their products.
But that made a big difference, didn't it?
Well, I was gone, so probably when this happened, so I just don't know, but I think it did.
I'm just guessing, because before then you had to look for a deposit that was accessible by rail.
Oh, I'm talking about the finished product.
Yes, but then you also had to have your
plant.
That's
true.
And your deliveries.
That's true.
Yeah. Okay. Have a little extra on the tape here.
I gotta make a little trip.
Okay, all right. Okay, well, yeah, you could. Fiberboard was a very big company, but you don't have any. Would you like to say any more about?
No, I think we better get on with
okay.
Kaiser Engineers.
All right.
Well, they were finished.
Right. Okay. Well, you had said yesterday that you thought that Emmett Solomon had helped a lot, and but you presented your idea of being a manager of their minerals division. I thought you replaced somebody named Ralph Bates.
How'd you know that?
Somebody, I don't know. Actually,
somebody told you.
I pick things
Ralph,
up and
Ralph,
make
well,
notes and keep them.
Well, no, I didn't really replace him. Ralph Bates was a top flight salesman for Kaiser Engineers. And what sales efforts were made in the minerals area were made by Ralph Bates, who was not a trained mining engineer, but was a superb salesman. When I first went with Kaiser Engineers, he and I worked together. He took me out on trips to talk with clients. But then he became very ill and died, actually. But by that time, I was beginning to get the reins in my own hands and realize what was needed. I was extremely impressed when I first went with Kaiser and Engineers, because I felt that they were the brightest and most versatile group of engineers I had ever met, which they probably were. We had several nuclei to build a minerals division on. There was no minerals division. In fact, at first I was just called manager of mineral projects. Later on, I was made a vice president of the minerals division, which was the objective of my going to Kaiser Engineering. But we had three nuclei in the company. One was a group of about three very intelligent engineers in the field of cement plant engineering. And they had just finished a cement plant for Kaiser Cement near Helena, Montana. And I was invited up to the dedication ceremonies. And the plant impressed me tremendously from its design.
Well, this belonged to Kaiser Cement.
We built it as Kaiser Cement was a client like any other.
Uh-huh.
And the Kaiser companies were clients of ours. Okay. And actually, as time went on, they became less important, and most of our work was outside. The Kaiser Group of Companies. But anyway, this cement plant showed a lot of ingenuity. And I remember telling the manager of the group, whose name escapes me, but I'll fill it in when we get to editing, I said, you people have got the capability to be the best cement plant mm-hmm. engineers in the United States.
Now, specifically, what was ingenious about the plant?
Well, it was the layout was ingenious. It was something entirely new.
In what?
In the, really, it was in the general layout of the plant, the relationship of the various parts.
I would think this would be, not knowing anything about it, I would think this would be pretty standard.
Well, yeah.
What makes one cement plant different from another?
Well, I don't know if we want to get into the detail of it because...
I do. Just some, anyway.
So. Well, the plant was physically streamlined, even to the point where the office and the laboratory were built in the bottom of the big silo. And very convenient location that was later copied in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I was impressed, and I felt that these people could really accomplish things. And this turned out to be true. Just every word of it turned out to be true. The group grew and did become, I think, accepted as the finest cement plant engineers in the country. And they got that reputation that at a period of time when a revolution was taking place in the industry, because the old plants had been so inefficient thermally, very high fuel costs, and it became very important to rebuild the old plants and to design the new plants in an entirely different way to make much more effective use of the fuel. So that was one group. The second group was just three engineers in the metals field who were in the Oakland office. This included Jim Thompson and George Measle, and the third one whose name I'll add when we get to editing it.
Mm-hmm.
These were very melting was the other MELTING, I can't think of his first name. Very capable men, and sort of working as individuals, but there was a nucleus of a technical group. And later on, Jim Thompson headed up a department in mineral technology and economy, which was very important to us and had quite a few people in it. So there was the beginning of something I could recognize. The third nucleus was a group of people who were working for Kaiser Canada, the Canadian subsidiary, headquartered in Montreal, and these people had built the Quebec Cartier iron ore concentrator in northern Quebec and were in the process of designing and building the Wabush concentrator in Labrador. As part of my indoctrination, I was sent along with a young Canadian engineer who'd been hired to be a sales engineer in Canada to visit these plants and some other facilities that Kaiser Engineers had built. So we went first to the Wabush concentrator in Labrador, and this was in the dead of winter, and we saw Kaiser Engineers building this plant under canvas, really. Very difficult conditions, and so cold that they never shut down their diesel trucks and other diesel-powered equipment. They kept them running 24 hours a day, and really a great achievement, but no more than other engineering companies have done in that far northern country. And then we grabbed a bush plane and flew to Quebec, northern Quebec, to the Quebec Cartier plant, and it was in operation. We had just finished it. So and then we went to Montreal, where the group was headquartered, the engineering group. The field people, of course, were out building Wabash, and I realized that here we had a tremendous pool of talent that was going to leave Canada and come back to Oakland. So these people were real experts now by this time in iron ore concentration. So I felt it very confident that we had some fine people available to put together as minerals division. The big problem was to get started in some areas where we were not known. We had no standing at all in the non-ferrous minerals. We had no standing at all in coal. So we had to organize a marketing plan, you might say, and a sales organization that could develop these areas plus the areas where we were already beginning to make some headway in cement and iron ore.
Who was your competition?
Well, our competition was Bechtel's own mineral division. Mm-hmm. And Parsons Churton, or Ralph M. Parsons Company, rather, the successor to Parsons Churton. And
Utah?
Not so much. An outfit in Denver, what was their name?
Is Stearns Rogers still?
Stearns Rogers, that's Denver. That's the one I'm trying to think of. And Wimco. Uh-huh. as well as others.
Were you competing?
Plenty of competition.
You know, people like Morrison Knudsen and Peter Kiewit and those?
Well, Morrison Knudsen later became active in the minerals industry, but and successfully, but not at this time. There were not competitors. And Peter Kiewit was primarily a dirt moving contractor, not a full service organization. Our purpose was to do planning and engineering and construction, the whole, be able to go the whole way with it. With a client, starting off, if necessary, with the exploration, carrying it right on through to the end, which we did in many instances.
But then you would still turn it over to another mining company at the end, or you planned to continue?
Oh no, we were strictly planners, engineers, and constructors. We were not operators.
Okay.
And of course, we had our origin was with Henry J. Kaiser as his engineering group as he built his industries up, you know.
So you weren't thinking of getting into operations?
Oh, no. No. Nor does somebody like Bechtel.
No.
Unless it's an extraordinary situation. No, we didn't. We like to do turnkey jobs and help the owner start up and then move off. Well, the first, as I recall, the first break we had in the non-ferrous metals industry was we landed a job to rebuild Kennecott Smelter near Salt Lake City.
Garfield
Smelter.
How did you get that?
Well, we made proposals, and there were three big parts of a modernization plant they were doing at that time, early 60s, and we proposed on all three, and they gave it to three different companies, and we drew the smelter, which was the most miserable job. Because we had to rebuild that Kennecott smelter while it was kept in operation.
Ooh.
And we found that we had a very bright young construction manager on the job. And
what was his name?
I'll tell you now.
Good on the spot.
But we did it. And we did it successfully, and that really was a starting point in the non-ferrous field. We also landed our first job with Asarco, and Asarco became a major client of ours over the years. A very fine relationship was developed for them. We did a variety of jobs for them.
What was the first one that you did?
Well, let's see. I guess the first job was a copper leaching plant in Arizona. And
You did a lead smelter in Missouri for them?
We did a lead smelter in Missouri for them. And we did work in the Idaho operations. And then we designed the Troy, Montana copper operations for them. So they became one of our best plants.
Now, did you have to acquire new? Did you have to acquire new staff to do some of these things? Were you building up a staff?
Our group continually grew.
I would think so.
While I was there, I knew nothing but growth. unfortunately. When I said WEMCO, I should say Western Mat Engineering.
Okay.
They were related, but it was really Western Mat Engineering. Over the 12 years I was with Kaiser Engineers, we just continued to grow and broaden our the type of work we could do. Our know-how in iron ore took us to Australia, where we worked for Hammersley Iron.
That was a big one, wasn't
it? Northwestern Australia. We did a lot of work for them up there. And then we were a group of companies. We were chosen to do a major exploration and planning job for an entire new iron ore complex in northwestern Australia. And each of these facilities was in the billion-dollar class, because you had to build new towns, new railroads, as well as new open pit mines and ports and the whole thing. And we did an extensive study for Mount Bruce Mining Company. That was to...
What was that?
Mount Bruce.
Okay.
That was a plan to bring in one more of these big producers. We accomplished all the work, including exploration and testing, and all of the layouts ready for detailed design. And the Japanese found that they were getting all the iron ore they could use from Australia, so this plan unfortunately did not go ahead after all our work. We also landed a job in excess of $100 million that time to build the new Tilden iron ore concentrator for Cleveland Cliffs, which was a very large job. And
where was that?
That was near Ishpeming, Michigan, on the northern Michigan. Another cold weather job, and a big one.
Talk about one that failed. Or did you ever have a failure? Did you ever have some that didn't work so well?
Well, I think our most peculiar job was it was for Kaiser Aluminum in Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, where they were they wanted to install a mine and concentrator working on I'll have to add the mineral name, which was used in particular kinds of high quality glass, like the fronts of television and so on. And it was a rush job, and we had to develop the process and build this plant. And when all this was done, they found the market wasn't what they thought it was, and they found that their mine was not what they thought it was, and this one had to go down as a failure. But I don't think that we can take the full blame for that. Well, generally we were successful. That's how we kept right on growing.
Mm-hmm. Now, in a case like that, the blame goes to Kaiser Aluminum and not to you.
Well, we were tarred, you know, by Kaiser Aluminum. But it was a toughie, a highly specialized job, done too fast. We went right from their laboratory bench to full scale design without a pilot plant, and it was a very difficult job. It just didn't work. Including their market projections.
There were some iffy things with Kaiser Steel.
We did a lot of work for Kaiser Steel, mostly done by our steel division, not my division, which undertook some very large steel mill expansions, not only for Kaiser Steel, but for Armco and other companies. I remember the Armco job was underway when I went to Kaiser Engineers, and it was called Project 600 because it was a $600 million job, which today you'd have to multiply by some number to estimate the site. It was a huge job in four different locations. But that was done by the steel division, you see. There were other divisions working right along as parallel with us in other mm-hmm. fields. I might talk a little bit about the sales effort.
Okay.
I'd come out of companies where marketing per se was very important, and I felt that the marketing concept, as compared with the sales concept, wasn't used enough in Kaiser Engineers, so we tried to develop a marketing system whereby we analyze projects all over the world that we expected to come into fruition, and we would analyze our possibilities of getting the work and what it would take to get the work, and build up a marketing plan every year with a five-year projection attached to it. A major help in this work was a man named Ed O'Connell, who was a superb salesman and had been watching us grow. He was with McKee, McKee, and he had been watching us grow and decided there was an opportunity for him with us, and came over to talk to me, and I was really happy to hire him. And,
just a second, Jack.